We live in a culture right now when it is virtually, well, it's impossible that you should ever miss a rerun. Have you noticed that if you had a television show that was your favorite from the 70s, the 80s, the 60s, going all the way back to the beginning of television, when your television was as big as a, I don't know, this big, sitting in the corner of your room, howdy doody. None of us go back that far, perhaps. My dad used to watch that when he was growing up. That you can get all of this probably at the library on DVD. And if you don't want to get it at the library on DVD, then you can get it on Netflix, or you can download it to your tablet or your computer or whatever. I mean, it's impossible that you should ever miss a rerun. One of the shows I watched when I was a kid was The Muppet Show. Don't raise your hand if you've ever watched it. Recently, we got that out from the library, and I enjoyed the comical adventures of Kermit the Frog and Miss Piggy. Our lives are a lot like that today. If we didn't catch it on Tuesday, we could get it on Thursday. And you know, if we miss church on Sunday, we could always download the sermon on whenever they get it up on the web. I mean, if you miss it here, you'll get it here. And we're so used to that. Food is instantaneous. Ah, I missed dinner. I'm going to stop by Chick-fil-A and get a chicken sandwich. Folks, I need to remind us this morning, right from the beginning of this sermon, is that that is not the way it is when it comes with gospel light. When it comes to opportunities in your Bible, people you might meet, for example, you are a Christian and Paul is coming back through your area, and you better spend time with him because you might never see him again. And there's no phone you can pick up. There's no internet that you can Skype him on. There's nothing. There's no letter service unless you're an extremely wealthy person and you can pay one of your servants to track him down and get a letter to him, or he sends a letter to you. There's nothing. In today's chapter, we see this individual, Felix. And he was a wicked man. He was known for his cruelty. He was recalled to answer to Nero and barely acquitted because of the political manipulations of his brother. He was acquitted. But if you look at your Bible today at Acts 24, and you look down at verse 27, you'll see that this man was given, really, in the book of Acts, an unprecedented opportunity to experience gospel light. It says in verse 27, after 2 years, Porcius Festus came into Felix's room, and Felix, willing to show the Jews a pleasure, left Paul bound. 2 years went by when the apostle Paul was incarcerated there with this individual. Now, Felix was not in jail with him, but we know by reading verses 25 and 26 that it was a common occurrence for Felix to go and talk to Paul. Now, think about this for a second. You have your own personal apostle locked in the jail next to your palace, or actually in your palace. And any day, any time of the day or night, you can go down and talk to him. But you say, now, wait a minute, his motives were mixed. Well, that's true. If you look at verse 26, it says he hoped also that money should have been given him of Paul, that he might loose him. He was looking to get some money, to get a bribe. He never did get one. But still, verse 25, Paul reasoned of righteousness and temperance and judgment. Felix trembled. He put off his decision, but he did say, I will call for thee. And he did call for him. And the wording here indicates that it was not a one-time call. There were multiple times when Felix, perhaps even his wife or his adulterous wife, it's another part of the story, was with him, Drusilla. At least once she was. But he failed. He failed to accept the message that Paul had to give him, even though he had his own private apostle, as it were, in his basement. Well, as we pick up the story today, back at the beginning of chapter 24, Paul is sitting there in jail. He's been carried to Caesarea. And he is waiting for the high priest or for someone from Jerusalem to come up and make the long trip and to accuse him there before Felix. And sure enough, it happens. Look at Acts 24, verse 1. After 5 days, Ananias, the high priest, descended with the elders and with a certain orator named Tertullus, who informed the governor against Paul. Now, it's interesting to note that it only took 5 days. That indicates that they were really in a rush. The high priest considered this a very important matter because he himself was willing to make the journey with the elders, and they hired a lawyer. Is it possible that this man, Tertullus, was a Roman citizen? Some say that he possibly was. It would have been a wise thing for them to find a lawyer who was a Roman citizen, because then it wouldn't have been Paul, the Roman citizen, versus these Jewish folks from Jerusalem, but it would have been this Roman lawyer who could have maybe gave a better impression upon Felix because of his citizenship. I don't know. The text does not say that. But it is important to indicate that they did spend their hard-earned money, perhaps money right out of the temple treasury, to hire a professional. They were quick. They took 5 days to get organized. The high priest was willing to go. They backed up their agenda with big bucks and a high-powered lawyer, and off they go. They still want Paul dead. They want him out of the picture. Verse 2. And when he was called forth, Tertullus began to accuse him. And yes, that is the way you're supposed to pronounce it. Tertullus. Sounds like turtle, doesn't it? But there's the pronunciation. He began to accuse him, saying. Now, his speech here, evidently, as historians have studied the speeches in court context in the Roman world, has three basic parts to it. The first was sort of the flattery part. And you can see that very clearly. He began to accuse him, saying, seeing that by thee, he's talking to Felix, we enjoy great quietness. One commentator made the point that it was the quietness of death, because Felix had put down any kind of revolt. He had killed their heroes. The Egyptian assassin was pro-Jewish. The high priest and the elders had every reason to hate Felix's guts. But they have the lawyer, and he knows how to speak rightly, and they back him up. So here's this flattery. Seeing that by thee we enjoy great quietness, and that very worthy deeds are done unto this nation by thy providence, we accept it always and in all places, most noble Felix, with all thankfulness. Notwithstanding, but I be not further tedious unto thee, I pray thee that thou wouldest hear us of thy clemency a few words. Now, there's a little argument here over whether he was just using flattery or whether he was being a little more devious, or we could say orderly or planned with his response here, what he said. I tend to lean toward the fact that these words were well chosen. They were intended to flatter, but also, as he accuses Paul of being everything Felix is not, according to his flattery, it is possible that he is flattering Felix so that when Paul is described, there would be quite a contrast between this man, Paul, and Felix. And so, it is also possible that this is just a summary of what he said, and that he went on for some time after this, going on and on and on. I don't know if that is true or not, but certainly he wanted to flatter. He was planned in what he was doing. And then at the end of it, if you look at verse 4, you know, give us a few words. We don't want to be further tedious unto thee, Felix. And then he gets into his accusations. Let's read verse 5. We found this man a pestilent fellow. Now, what kind of an accusation is that? It means literally a plague. We found this man a plague, a mover of sedition among the Jews throughout the world, and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes, who also hath gone about to profane the temple, whom we took and would have judged according to our law. But the chief captain, Lysias, Lysias came upon us and with great violence took him away out of our hands, commanding his accusers to come unto thee, by examining of whom thyself mayest take knowledge of all these things whereof we accuse him. And the Jews assented. What is he accusing him of? Well, as already mentioned, first there's just this character assassination by labeling him a plague. But the type of vocabulary he uses, the implication is, what do you do with the plague? You want to contain it. You don't want it to get out into the empire and create havoc and death. But that's what Paul is. He is, look at verse 5, a mover of sedition among the Jews throughout the world. Now, sedition was a very serious charge under Roman law. If you were someone stirring up trouble against the Pax Romana, if you were someone who could break the peace that was a troublemaker, you could, and you would, it was serious. And what kind of troublemaker is he? Verse 5. Well, his sedition is focused on the Jews throughout the world, and he's a ringleader. And the word translated ringleader there is a quasi-military word. It has to do with someone who is almost of military rank. So here he's describing Paul as a plague that needs to be contained and a dangerous leader of a faction. And of course, Felix is probably the one who put down the Egyptian who was the assassin. And he is trying to lift, the lawyer here is trying to put Paul up there right side by side with that Egyptian person who was willing to kill leader of a faction in a plague. Not only that, verse 6, but here's the specific charge. He's gone about to profane the temple. So all these things are known about him. He came to our temple. He went in. And of course, we know that the claim is he took a Gentile in there to profane the temple. And that is when we took him, verse 6, and we would have judged him according to our law. That judgment, I guess, and is taking him out and viciously killing him outside the city. I guess that's the judgment according to his law, instantaneous death in his mind. But verse 7, you guys came, took him out of our hands. Now, that is a very wise accusation and wisely put. But I want you to notice when Paul defends himself, Paul was not a country bumpkin. This man was one of the best scholars of his age. As a matter of fact, there are those who say if he had entered secular philosophy, if he had gone into another discipline, he would have been just as famous as some of the most famous Greek philosophers. Maybe you would have something written by Paul the philosopher if that's what he did. He understood how to handle himself in a courtroom, and we'll see that by his response. Verse 10. Then Paul, after that the governor had beckoned unto him to speak, probably a motion with his hand, answered, for as much as I know that thou hast been of many years a judge unto this nation, I do the more cheerfully answer for myself. You notice immediately that there's no real flattery there. He doesn't lie. He doesn't butter the man up. But he does say that Felix was there for a number of years, and so he should have some experience and be able to accurately measure what's going on. Verse 11. Because that thou mayest understand that there are yet but 12 days since I went up to Jerusalem for to worship. Now he begins with the accusation that is specific. Felix, he came to our temple and profaned it. And he begins there by saying that only took place recently, Felix. Not a long time ago in the unsubstantiated past. The implication is because it happened recently, evidence should be relatively easy to gather. That's the implication. Look at verse 11 again. I went up to Jerusalem for to worship, and they neither found me in the temple disputing with any man, neither raising up the people, neither in the synagogues, nor in the city. Neither can they prove the things whereof they now accuse me. So the first thing he does is he attacks their ability to prove that he was in the temple profaning it or stirring up disputations in the city streets of Jerusalem. Now, under Roman law, if you're going to make an accusation like this, it happened this recently. Those who accuse him, who were the witnesses, should have been there. They should have been present. Tertullus should have been able to say, okay, Felix, Here's our witnesses. These men saw Paul in the temple with a Greek. Would you please come forward to bear testimony to what you saw? Under Roman law, if they were not present, the Roman law frowned greatly upon that. And that was a major flaw in their case not to have real witnesses present. So he's attacking their ability to prove, verse 13, the things whereof they now accuse him. They cannot prove it. You'll also notice that when he talks about being in the streets, he doesn't talk about all the things that happened all over the empire, everywhere in the ancient Mediterranean world. He's specific about what happened in Jerusalem 12 days ago. He's narrowing it down, simplifying the whole issue for Felix. Then in verse 14, he changes his tactics. He makes a confession. Interesting thing to do when you're on trial. But this I confess unto thee, that after the way which they call heresy, so worship I the God of my fathers, believing all things which are written in the law and in the prophets, and have hope toward God, which they themselves also allow, that there shall be a resurrection of the dead, both of the just and the unjust. And herein do I exercise myself, to have always a conscience void of offense toward God and toward men. Now after many years I came to bring alms to my nation and offerings, whereupon certain Jews from Asia found me purified in the temple, neither with multitude nor with tumult, who ought to have been here before thee and object if they had aught against me. Or else let these same here say if they have found any evil doing in me while I stood before the council, except it be for this one voice that I cried, standing among them, touching the resurrection of the dead, I'm called into question you this day. Now he is willing, even as he defends himself, to be a witness, to make a public confession as to what he believes. But in this case, his public confession is that he is not a strange sect, although he certainly worships the Nazarene, but that he is a good Jew who was following the Jewish law when he was in the temple. The certain Jews from Asia, they found him, verse 18, purified in the temple. He went to great lengths to make sure he was clean before he helped those Nazarites out. So I want to stop here for a second and remind you that Paul and even the early Christians, especially the Jewish ones, they did not view themselves as being outside of their Old Testament. Do you remember what Jesus said when it came to the law and the prophets? He said, I have not come to destroy the law and the prophets, but what? To fulfill them. And so Paul's message when he's around the Jews is not that he brings another religion, but that Jesus is the Messiah prophesied in the Old Testament, the Jewish Messiah. And it's finished. Brothers, we found the Messiah, the one prophesied in our Old Testament. And so he makes this case before the court here and before Felix that he is a good Jew and he is not outside of the Jewish religion in that sense. And then in verse 20, he just plainly states that the whole argument is over. Look at it again. They found any evil doing in me while I stood before the council. Their whole argument, he says, is because his particular belief does not match with the belief of the Sadducees, because he accepts the whole Old Testament as authoritative and inspired of God, which the Sadducees did not. And finally, what he does is he turns the whole situation around, and the only witnesses that were present, the very council members, the high priest and the elders, he calls them. He makes his accusers into his star witnesses. And so they're standing there, and Felix could have said, what happened? You tell me. What did you see at that council meeting? And they would have had to admit that it was all about this thing where he cried, verse 21, standing among them, touching the resurrection of the dead, I am called in question. And so he's done. He's done with his defense. He understands Roman law. He understands the necessity of witnesses being there. He throws the whole thing back on them. All the while, he's a witness to the resurrection of Christ, the sect of the Nazarenes. Verse 22, Felix heard these things. Now, Felix also had some experience with Christianity. That's what verse 22 tells us. He has a more perfect knowledge of that way. And you could capitalize the word way because this is an expression, this is a word that's used to describe Christians. He deferred them and said, when Lysias, the chief captain, shall come down, I will know the uttermost of your matter. And he commanded a centurion to keep Paul and to let him have liberty, and that he should forbid none of his acquaintance to minister or come unto him. Felix puts the whole matter off. Now the question immediately arises, did he ever call for the captain, the good captain, down there in Jerusalem? Was a messenger ever dispatched? I need you to come. I need you to tell me what happened. We know that he already received a letter, right? If you look back at chapter 23 and you look at verse 25, it says he wrote a letter after this manner. Here's the good captain, and he addresses Felix, most excellent governor. That's verse 26. And then he describes what happened. Now, he made himself look really good, but he did give him the basic problem of the whole case, and his assessment is verse 29. Look at it. Acts 23, verse 29. I perceived to be accused of questions of their law, but to have nothing laid to his charge worthy of death or of bonds. That was his testimony. Felix really didn't need anything else. So it's probable that he's just making an excuse. He's putting the decision off, and he's doing it for a number of reasons. The first one being that even Felix needed the support of the high priest and those elders in Jerusalem. How did Pilate act when the whole city was in an uproar and they brought Jesus before him? Was Pilate willing to bend the rules and to send an innocent man to a cross just to placate the high priest and the Sanhedrin? Yes, he was. Because like it or not, in the ancient world, the popular vote didn't exist in the sense that it does in America, but it certainly existed in some form, i.e. assassins, rebellion, all kinds of civil unrest. Felix needed their support. It's possible that verse 27 is referring to when he was hauled off before Caesar and had to give his account and defend himself. And he would need those people in Jerusalem to write a correspondence to Rome saying, yes, we liked Felix. And if he had set Paul free after they went to all this trouble, what would they say? What would they say to the government about Felix? So that is probably one of the reasons. Second one being, he knew how to manipulate the system to get a few bucks. And so he was hoping that Paul recognizes there's no case. So here, take some money and let's put this whole thing behind us. And so he puts Paul in a very easy confinement. He's not down there with the other prisoners. He's a Roman citizen. So look at verse 23 of chapter 24 again. He commanded a centurion to keep Paul and to let him have some liberty, and that he should forbid none of his acquaintance to minister or come unto him. Now, the word liberty there is probably not a reference to him getting to go out and around the city, although I don't know that he would be able to do that or not. If you want to say that he could, you can't really make that argument from the word liberty here. It simply means that the movement that he enjoyed in the palace in prison was not as confined as, say, Peter chained between two guards. He could have his friends come and go, minister to his needs, and he could have relative freedom as compared to someone else in solitary confinement or rotting in the dungeon. So there he goes. Now, how would you feel after all that? Imagine for a second you are walking away, probably still in chains. I don't know how tight they are on your wrists. They're metal, probably. Maybe there's some wood involved in it, but they're not comfortable. You've just once again borne witness to your Lord. You've wisely defended yourself. You know you're guilty of no crime, and yet those men are the one going back to Jerusalem, and you're the one going down those stone stairs to your cell. It might be a room, might be a little nicer, but you're still confined. Would you think your ministry is over? Would you give up? You're probably still pretty sore because it was only 12 days ago that you were involved in all of these adventures and all of this suffering. I imagine that if you and I would be pretty discouraged at this point. But that is not God's perspective. Because if you remember, when Paul was knocked off his horse in the dirt there on the road, Jesus said that you'll bear witness to me among the Jews and the Gentiles and who else? Kings. People of authority. And it really is amazing that Jesus allows Paul to be in this situation for 2 years. And he's a witness to everyone. And to Felix. Look at verse 24. After certain days, when Felix came with his wife, Drusilla, which was a Jewess, he sent for Paul and heard him concerning the faith in Christ. Now, Drusilla, this was her second husband, and she ran off to commit adultery with Felix. Felix actually conspired with a local cult leader to get her away from her husband to become his. She is Felix's third wife. She obviously has been involved in a great deal of sin, and she should have known better. She was Jewish. A Jewess, as the King James Version says. But she wants to know about Paul. And Felix brings her. And look at what it says here in verse 24. It's very specific. They heard him concerning the faith in Christ. Now, the way that's phrased, it definitely indicates the Messiah, the faith in Messiah. It has that Jewish flavor to it where she wants to know the Jewish Messiah. Has he come? She's curious. So verse 25, they call Paul before them. And this is a very interesting expression here in verse 25, how he reasoned with them of righteousness, temperance, and judgment. Now these, although Felix is a Gentile and his wife is a Jew, they had some knowledge about the way. He doesn't go about the same way he did on Mars Hill to talk about God establishing the seasons and feeding everyone and putting boundaries on the nations. He assumes that they know God. They have some knowledge of the one true God. At least they know, even if they haven't trusted in him. And so he begins his gospel declaration here with the matter of God's righteousness. Now, what is God's righteousness? That has to do with God's standard of perfection and his requirements. Then he talks about temperance. Temperance is self-control. It's our response to God's righteousness. Judgment is what is going to happen to all of us down the road when it comes to our self-control and how it relates to God's standards and rules. Now imagine for a moment how bold this must have been. I don't know if he knew about Drusilla and the backstory there. But here's Paul, and he begins by talking about the righteousness of God. Now, you're here this morning. Has there been a time in your life when you've accepted the standards of God as being right? For example, we're living in a culture today when marriage really has not, the boundaries of it have pretty much been erased. Do you understand that it's God's standard? This is what he wants for a man and a woman to be married for life. He's against adultery. Thou shalt not commit adultery. A matter of fact, and we've talked about this at length the past few months, but when it comes to elders in his church, he wants them to be a one-woman man. He wants them to be fully, wholeheartedly dedicated to their wife and no one else. Not just in the externals, but down to their very bones, in their heart. And that means, husbands, that there's no fantasizing about what ifs, if this woman or that woman. There's no getting right up to the line with some female coworker. I mean, God is interested. When it comes to His standard, it goes right from the actions all the way down into the heart of hearts. When it comes to God's standard of righteousness, He says absolutely, positively, no coveting. Whatever you have, work hard for it. Increase your material goods through wisdom. That's taught in Proverbs. But if you don't have it, you don't take it from your neighbor. But it's beyond that, folks. You don't even imagine what it would be like to take it from your neighbor. Your neighbors, we could put a modern application on this, their cars, their spouse, their house, or their job. And so Paul would go and talk along these lines to Felix and Drusilla, perhaps looking up if they're on a raised platform of some sort, looking down at him, talking about the righteousness of God, the righteousness of God, the righteousness of God. And then there's this, Felix and Drusilla, where do your actions stand in reference to God's righteous standard? Are you good enough? Have you succeeded in meeting that standard? Here it is. And what was Felix's response? Look at it again. Verse 25. Felix trembled. Folks, that's the power of the gospel. That's the power of the Spirit of God taking the Word of God. Here is this wicked, reprobate of a man. When his conscience accuses him, he trembles. Just imagine Drusilla standing here next to him, or perhaps they're seated. There's this trembling, and she feels through her shoulder this tremble coming from him. It's an amazing thing. Have you ever trembled at the righteous standard of God and your inability through self-control to ever meet it? Because he does talk about the judgment. I mean, that's the day when God takes all of us and he presents his righteous standard, and the question comes up, do you have the righteousness that matches this righteousness? And anyone that is outside of Christ, who hasn't been given, imputed with Christ's righteousness, will fall short. What did Paul say at that moment? Felix, there is a day of coming judgment. It's appointed unto man once to die, and after this the judgment. And you and Drusilla will... Was he this direct? You, Felix, and you, Drusilla, you'll stand before the Almighty Righteous God. What will you say? Was he that bold? I like to think he was. The response is a failure in verse 25. Go thy way for this time. When I have a convenient season, I will call for thee. Now, it was bad, but it wasn't a lie. He called for him. His motives were mixed. Verse 26, he hoped also that money should have been given him. And so there was a second time. Felix came and Paul talked. And you can imagine that Paul, a faithful witness, would tell him again and again and again. But folks, the day came when Felix was gone. He was taken out of that situation, and this other man, in verse 27, Porcius Festus came in. There's very little known about him. And that was it. Did Felix ever get another opportunity? Did Felix ever tremble again? Now, you might be here this morning, and you might be a lost person. You could even come to church for years and years and years. And you keep telling yourself, I'll get saved tomorrow. But folks, what happens if you don't tremble tomorrow? What happens if you've so scarred your conscience, seared it with a hot iron, as the New Testament says, that when the Spirit of God starts moving in your heart, you no longer feel it? You say, now, wait a minute, Dan, can't God save anyone at any time in their life? Sure He can. But from your human responsibility, from how responsible you and I are toward God, putting off salvation is a stupid thing to do. Because you could walk out of these doors again and never hear another gospel message. You could go to work and never work with another Christian again. And no one would ever put righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to you again in your entire life. Is that possible? Yes, folks, it's very possible. We have knocked on doors in this neighborhood, in Elk Ridge, a few streets down, people that have never heard about Jesus one time in the United States of America.